This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil premieres April 30th, only on Hulu.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
The XX Gab Fest is brought to you by JibJab.com. With a JibJab e-card, you can send a hilarious, personalized Christmas greeting to your friends and family. Choose from hundreds of animated e-cards, from merry to edgy. They're fun and easy to create from any device. Make your own personalized holiday card in seconds at JibJab.com and use the promo code XX. The following podcast contains explicit language.
Welcome to the XX Gab Fest for Thursday, October 13th, the Say Yes Please to Hog Castration edition. I'm Hannah Rosen, a writer for Slate, joined in New York by June Thomas, editor of Outward, Slate's LGBTQ blog. Hi, June.
Hello, Hannah.
How are you? And I thought I was getting it down. And Noreen of New York Magazine. Hi, Noreen.
Hi.
So our three topics today are, first, we'll discuss the midterm elections and women. If a conservative woman wins, is it still good for women? Second, Amy Poehler's new memoir, Yes, Please, which is out this week. And third, Valerie Jarrett, the president's closest advisor, consigliere, whisperer, is a woman. How strange is that? So before we get going, I want to pose to you guys another dilemma. I was on Mom and Dad Are Fighting. I was a sub co-host last week. And in the beginning, they talk about parenting dilemmas. And I mentioned one which my friends have just been berating me about all week. And so I want to pose it to our listeners and get your comments on our Facebook page. Here's the situation. My daughter was dressing up for Halloween and she decided she wanted to be Hillary Clinton. And so she and I were in the bathroom together and she was putting on what she perceived to be political lady makeup. Me and she was like putting on, you know, mascara and a little lip gloss and whatever. And I looked at her and out of my mouth came the words, "Oh my God, you look so much better." And you know, she was like jokingly offended, but not actually offended. And so the question is, like, am I the worst mother ever? I don't know, guys. What is even the question that I'm asking our listeners to comment on?
I think it might be terrible mother or worst mother ever.
She'll be fine. If she was jokingly offended, she'll be fine.
If she was actually offended, she will say that to her shrink. Like, 20 years from now, her shrink will be processing that for, like, 4 sessions, and I'll have cost her $1,000 or whatever it is that shrinks will cost in those days. Anyway, if any of our listeners have ever said or slipped up in that similar way with, I guess it's a daughter problem. No, I think dads can do this in sports, too. So, you know, confess. Okay. So let's go to our first topic, the midterm elections. A lot of firsts for women in this election. Joni Ernst, Iowa's first female senator. Maya Love, the first black female Republican. And the total number of women in both houses moved into the triple digits. But does it count as good for women if the women don't support the traditional feminist agenda? Let's start with the obvious one, who's Joni Ernst. She's former military. She sponsors a personhood amendment. She voted to defund Planned Parenthood. And she didn't seem to mind when Iowa Senator Tom Harkin said she was as good-looking as Taylor Swift and as nice as Mr. Rogers. That's a quote.
Creepy.
Is that creepy? That's such a, like, Playboy girl next door. Noreen, as the new expert on Playboy models. Noreen did a fabulous feature in New York Magazine about Playboy models of days of yore. Isn't that such a Playboy model kind of thing to say to somebody, the girl next door-ish?
I guess it just seems like the weird combination with Mr. Rogers, like, takes it to this like kind of elderly man, very young woman level. That's very Gross.
Creepy.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go back to Joni Ernst. Okay, so what's your, you guys, you hear that somebody like that is elected. Where does your good for women, bad for women meter go immediately? This is like a sub-Sarah Palin moment, right?
See, I flash right back to the days of Margaret Thatcher, who dominated my youth and who was an incredibly powerful woman, but was also incredibly conservative and really not very good for women, except in the sense that she was modeling strong female, powerful female behavior. And I have to say, too, that the whole thing with Ernst, I was really bugged that a British radio show, The News Quiz, just played that whole hog castrating ad in full without even commenting, because it was just, you know, oh, ha ha, Americans, aren't they wacky?
Wait, explain it for people who haven't heard the hog castration.
So I guess the hog, she did an ad where she, I have to say that I kind of can't remember, other than that she talked about how she loved to castrate hogs and how she was going to go to Congress in Washington, D.C. and castrate some pork.
Yeah, that seems like a bad. She grew up on a farm, right? Mm-hmm. And that was, that's about the long and short of it, which is sort of crazy that that was a ad that, you know, consultants signed off on.
Right. And that, you know, Brits and foreigners just laugh at to show how wacky we Americans are and how crazy our gun mad culture is. Ugh.
But isn't there some like wicked feminist streak in that hog castration, just as there was some secret wicked feminist streak in Sarah Palin, or no?
Yeah, I mean, yes. That's the crazy thing, that I mean, that they're both women who know their way around guns, that, you know, Joni Ernst is a veteran, for goodness sake. There's clear, powerful, strong images. At the same time, she wants to take away reproductive rights. She will make the lives of women much more difficult and precarious.
Yeah, I feel like we are sort of past the phase where we need symbols, I hope. Mm. Like, we don't need a Margaret Thatcher. What is sort of maddening for me, I mean, on the one hand, I do want to say, okay, like, it's very reductive to say that it's only good for women if the women who are elected happen to agree with me. But the whole question of, is this good for women or bad for women, I think is actually kind of reductive. Is it good for people, for Americans, or bad for people and Americans, I think is like a better question. I'm almost offended, not quite offended, but sort of maddened that the only way consultants and campaigns go after women is by like highlighting the craziness of Republicans and reproductive rights. It sort of distracts from what the common ground could be for both men and women and Republicans and Democrats, which is like questions of the economy and social services. And so Democrats won big time with women, but they sure didn't win big time overall.
I so agree with you, Noreen. I think if you talk about the women's vote separately, you get trapped in this corner where every woman elected official has to match what the women's vote is. I mean, I think normalization means women of all kinds. See, I think it's really good when women run against women in races, when basically women, we move towards a world in which women are doing what men do in elected politics. They come in all stripes. They belong to all different movements. Some of them are good for women and some of them are not good for women, or good for, say, a woman like me. Like, as Jess Gross points out in her post in Slate, women and men split pretty evenly on their views on reproductive rights, as it turns out, right? Like, not all women are pro-choice, I guess. I mean, many of them are pro-life. And so it seems like defining people as good for women or bad for women is maybe not where the future is. I think the outrage is in how few women elected officials. Like, I think that's something we can still get. I know that's like number bean counting, and we should be over that in the same way, like you say, we should be over symbols. But it is a little weird how slow that progress
is. But don't women just not want to go work in politics, which I think happens to be a sign of superior intelligence on our part? Like, they've done all kinds of studies. You know, there are sort of the usual reasons that, you know, women in their 30s tend to drop off when they have children in politics, as in other things, maybe. But also just women don't crave this career in the same way that men seem to. And since for my money, in order to seek elected office in America in 2014, you have to be like a raging narcissist with a number of other borderline personality problems. It's probably good for women that there aren't so many of us.
You know, did you guys read that Brookings report? I thought that was so interesting. We will post it on our show page, but there was a Brookings report out this week which really finally parsed that question of when women's ambitions to be in politics drift away. And the key moment is between high school and college. So if you look at high school women and you ask them the question, you know, do you want to be a politician? Do you have aspirations? Do you want to be in leadership? There's not that great a gap. But as soon as they get to college, there is a gap. That's so interesting. That's when it starts to open up. Like when things loosen up, you know, you get to determine your own interests and your own time. Now, I wasn't sure if in reading that report, I was supposed to conclude what you said, Noreen. Well, women are just not into it, because once they're out of this very rigid, you know, high school environment where you can run in this very specific way and your classes are determined for you and they get to just choose what they want, they don't choose to be political science majors. They choose something else. And so are we supposed to then conclude, well, fine, they're not into it?
Well, there are plenty of women working in politics. I think it's more the question of wanting to seek office themselves or not. You know, they get to campus and they see the college Republicans and college Democrats and they just don't want anything to do with that, maybe.
You know, in Britain, there's a thing because they're trying to, you know, take efforts to have more women in parliament, of having female-only shortlists, which are, so, you know, when they're choosing candidates. And it's very controversial because, I mean, partly because it's that, you know, little bit condescending, we're going to, you know, socially engineer this. And also it is just a reminder of how much politics is done from outside, that there's not just people coming up within the constituency, but people, sort of professional politicians coming in from outside. But at the same time, it does seem like it has been effective in terms of getting more women into parliament. And I'm surprised in a way, even though I do pretty much agree with you, Noreen, that there haven't been more attempts to do things like that in this country. Hannah, I'm curious, do you think that the lack of women in Congress, I mean, it's what, 20% of the Senate and 18% of the House, does that kind of challenge your end of men thesis?
Yes, definitely challenges my end of men thesis. I mean, there are places where women don't, you know, as you know, as time goes on, I realize it's a cultural story more than it is a kind of structural story, because the richest people, the very richest people, are still men, and most political officials are still men. Now, what happens if Hillary becomes president? Like, then do I become right again? I mean, it's like sometimes I seem right, sometimes I seem completely wrong. It's totally plausible that Hillary will become president, right?
Well, yeah, but they still will only be, you know, 100 women in both houses of Congress. So it still doesn't seem like everything's been upturned. I mean, just because we've had a black president, it doesn't mean that, you know, people of color in politics has transformed. It's pretty much stayed kind of how it was, except, of course, now we do have the first black woman Republican coming into Congress. So maybe that is, things are starting to change, perhaps.
So do you think those European ways are the only ways to do it? You know, like you can only force women on boards by instituting quotas. You know, you have to institute quotas for elected officials the way they do in these post-war torn countries. They often say, you know, NATO or the UN comes in and says you have to have X number of women elected officials on these local political governing bodies.
Well, and you're right to also mention that there's the same thing is done on boards of companies. I don't know if it's the only way, but it does also seem to be effective.
I don't know. I think quotas are bad for women in the American experiment, generally.
Fair enough.
So here's the thing about having more women. Why do we want more women? There's this fantasy that if you have more women, then you will have more cooperation and, you know, things will be more harmonious, which is something we especially need now because there's so much partisan rancor. So do you guys think that's true? Like if we up the number, is that, you know, if you're making arguments for political reform, less money in politics, maybe women are worse at raising money, is one of them that there's so much partisanship and women could solve that problem?
Well, I don't know, having not personally worked in Congress, but it does seem as if a lot of the, for instance, Republicans who are willing to compromise with Democrats, the Susan Collins of the world, are women. That just does seem to be borne out. And it does make sense to me that if you are an extreme minority in a group, you might bond with other extreme minorities, whether they happen to agree with your, you know, views on whatever tax bill or not. And it's a glad-handing kind of business. So, yeah, it makes sense to me.
I tend to see everything through the lens of television. And it does seem that the better television shows have very mixed writers' rooms. Like, if everybody looks alike, you don't go beyond your limited little world. And so just having more different kinds of people in any kind of room, whether it's a Senate chamber or a TV writer's room, I think is always better.
Yeah, I'm with you, June. I don't necessarily think women are more cooperative or peaceable. There's not a lot of data or evidence that supports that. But I do think that just having more different types of people leads to a different creative flourishing and different points of view. So that may lead in lots of different places, but I think it's good. It like breaks a stalemate mm-hmm. more than it creates a union.
Yeah.
All right, on that happy note, let's move on to our second topic, which is Amy Poehler's new book. But before we do that, we would like to thank our new sponsor, JibJab.
I'm sure everyone knows JibJab. They do the hilarious dancing Christmas elves that you can put your face in. And I did one, and it was super fun and easy. Because let's face it, sending out paper holiday cards can be a pain. You have to plan way ahead, like I'm starting now with my holiday card list. I'm sure everyone else here is. You have to order the cards. You have to get an ungodly amount of stamps and write the same thing over and over. But JibJab.com is a way more fun and an easy alternative to sending boring holiday cards that people open and throw away. On JibJab.com, you can create and share personalized holiday greetings starring your friends and family. And it's easy. You make them from your computer, your tablet, or your phone in seconds. So basically what happens, you take a photo of yourself, of your face, and then you can put it onto, you know, these characters that they have made, and you kind of line up where your eyes are and where your mouth is. I did one, Hannah, in the spirit of, like, faith cooperation. I thought I was making a Hanukkah card. Because,
oh my God, you're such a woman.
I know,
so
right? I was just like opening up to other experiences. And then actually it turned out that Macareindeer was a reference to reindeers doing the Macarena, not to the Maccabees of the Hanukkah story. But it was really fun to see myself as a reindeer doing the Macarena. So, you know, and I you could send that to your friends and, you know, they would no doubt use it against you for years to come.
I will say kids are super into JibJab. All of my children went through a phase of making just insane JibJab cards and sending them to all of their friends. It's like incredibly funny and fun thing to do.
And you have teenage boys, and I'm sure the emphasis on, like, for example, I'll mention that some of the cards that are currently available are Santa's Twerk Shop, the Macareindeer, which I had a lot of fun with, the Butt Cracker, Rockin' Round the Christmas Tree, and hundreds more. Just pick a card theme, upload a picture, type a greeting, and hit send. Suddenly, you're Santa's favorite elf, shaking it like a Christmas present, which your friends and family will love. They're available for birthdays, anniversaries, Valentine's Day. Get an extra discount with promo code XX. Go to jibjab.com and get an extra discount with the promo code XX.
Easy enough. Thank you. So let's move on to Amy Poehler's new book, Yes, Please, is out this week. Hers is the latest in a series of memoirs and books by lady comedians Tina Fey, Mindy Kaling, Chelsea Handler, Lena Dunham, and a protege of Amy Poehler's, Megan Amram. Let's discuss Poehler's book first and the origins and meanings of this flourishing subgenre. So, June, you were apparently a big fan of Yes, Please. Well, first of all, can we all agree we like Amy Poehler? Like, everyone loves Amy Poehler, right?
Yes.
Do you know
yes.
anybody who doesn't love Amy Poehler? No. We
no.
all love her. She's just lovable, right?
She's amazing, yes.
She's amazing. And the role in Parks and Rec is she's so sweet, right? She doesn't have that hard edge. I mean, she's just kind of amazing. And I actually, in preparing for the segment, watched that Saturday Night Live Amy Poehler, Sarah Palin rap maybe like 20 times. I mean, it's just so damn good. You know, when she's 9 months pregnant and she's screaming, I'm an animal, like so convincingly. It's so good. She's really good. But June, you really liked the memoir, which critics were very mixed on. So I would say negative to mixed and then a couple slightly positive.
Yeah, I was surprised because I haven't read a book like this in decades. I mean, when I was young, I remember buying kind of similar books by stars that I liked, and it was just, you know, a thing that you got for a holiday present. And then it wasn't something that I bought or read for a long time. And I tend not to like I don't like short fiction. I don't like little books with little chapters that are not really connected, which this is. It's very much like, you know, some of the pieces are just a couple of pages, some are five pages. It's like, it's very mixed. It's a real curate's egg, good in parts. And unfortunately, it starts with a really terrible part where she goes on and on about how hard it is to write a book, which anybody knows is something you should never say.
Because, why did she do that? Do you think she was just lowering expectations? Or what was up with that introduction? It was so – it would have worked if it was really, really funny.
Yeah.
You know, like all of the books kind of do that. Like Tina Fey's book, you know, makes fun of the genre of book. It's very meta, Tina Fey's introduction, but it's so funny, you know? Yeah. And this one is kind of meta, but not that funny. It's really just talking to your neurotic friend who's writing a book and doesn't know what she's doing.
Right. And then she doesn't let go of it. She keeps referring back to the difficulty of writing a book throughout. And I just hated that.
That was a terrible mistake. She can't, like, live life without a bit.
Right. And actually, that did become very clear that, like, just as on Saturday Night Live or any other, you know, she's really into improv comedy, they don't all work. Some of them fall flat and, you know, the secret is to commit. And so there were parts that I really didn't care for, but there were also parts that I loved. I thought that she was an amazing writer. I liked this book more than I liked Lena Dunham's book. I thought that Amy Poehler had really moments of incredible perceptiveness. I laughed out loud, which is not something I generally do when reading a book. I actually...
Okay, wait. Slow down this love fest. you thought they were brilliant. What was brilliantly written? Like, which parts were
brilliantly
written?
It was at a sentence level. There would be sentences that I thought she really was incredibly perceptive. So this book, like a lot of these books, is written as a kind of a fake advice book. Mm-hmm. And I actually did feel like I received life lessons from this book.
I gotta say, as like a longtime huge Amy Poehler fan, I am not on the same boat you are on, June. It's fine. It's like a fine couple hundred pages, reads quickly. And it made me like her. Like she, you know, there's sort of, you see the sort of like darkness behind the sort of sweetness that she is balancing. And that was really interesting to see, but I don't think she's a good writer. And I, especially in comparison to the Lena Dunham book, which we talked about a couple weeks ago, I would like much rather hang out with Amy Poehler than Lena Dunham. But on the page, I'd rather hang out with Lena Dunham than Amy Poehler.
I so agree. I found myself looking, because I like her so much, looking for reasons to justify the book. I was like, you know, part of me, I was at war with myself. One part of me was like, I really wish she hadn't written this book because I love her so much. And so I don't want to know all this stuff. And then the other part of me was thinking, well, maybe it's because she's so sweet that she doesn't get into the truly dark meta stuff that Tina Fey does. Like Tina Fey is always sort of deflecting with jokes so hard, you know, in the way that Lena Dunham is sort of weirdly deflecting with self-revelations, as we discussed in our last podcast. Right. But Amy Poehler's not really doing that. She's really just chatting with you. Like the number of times the phrase "that being said" was in the book, you should never write that being said. That should be cut out, you know, in the next draft. And so there was something so chatty about it. I love the parts about improv when she was describing how improv works and what those early years were like, because that's a subject I'm really interested in, but just don't know that much about, you know? Mm-hmm. What's the bravery involved in doing improv? Like, I felt like you would go into improv as a young person and come out like one tough, brave motherfucker. You would just go in there and, like, you just have to get up on that stage and that whole thing she says where don't think, you know? Mm-hmm. Just turn your brain off and just commit. And, like, the failure is a failure to commit. That was so interesting that you get booed off the stage. And I forgot what – there's a specific boo that they say to you, which was very interesting. But you get booed off the stage if you kind of abandon your partner. It's like a relationship thing. Like if you fail to commit to the whatever sketch your partner set up and that's just clear, that's the big failure in improv. I thought that stuff was so interesting.
Yeah, I liked that stuff. I also liked like the stuff about her kids and her feelings. And the one part that springs to mind that I found quite intense and moving was when she talked about an apology that she hadn't made and then eventually made. So it was about a sketch in Saturday Night Live that she kind of hadn't realized was referring to something real. And it turned out that it was kind of making fun of a real handicapped person. And she was told this because Chris Carter and his wife, the actor Chris Carter and his wife, who had had a handicapped son and who were just kind of sensitive to these issues, I guess, told someone, another famous person, which kind of, you know, complicates things. It sounds like humble bragging, that that they had been hurt. And she wanted to apologize to them, and she sat with it, and she didn't. And then eventually she did, and there was some, like, they actually she showed the hard emails to read where somebody was confronting her with their failure to apologize. And that, you know, I've done that. I've messed up and not apologized and been tortured by it for years and maybe had an opportunity to make up kind of almost for that. And I know that seemed real. And I know that realness and honesty aren't real, something that we say we want, but it's not really what we want, because realness and honesty can be supremely boring. Like, my honest response to a lot of things is, eh, and that's not interesting. But there was something about her version of, you know, the version of Amy Poehler who comes through in this book is somebody who is different from the person who she is on stage or on camera. But I don't know. I really liked it.
Yeah, I liked it as character study. She tends to be set up against Tina Fey a lot because they're best friends and their careers sort of were in tandem. And I do that, too. I sort of identify more with Amy Poehler than Tina Fey. And what was nice about this was sort of realizing, like, Amy Poehler doesn't wake up in the morning and feel all sweetness and light. Like, she talks a lot about how there's a whole section where she watches really dark news stories very closely as a way of sort of, like, using them to unlock, you know, feelings in herself that she sort of repressed. That's, like, some dark shit, you know? Yeah. And I think it just makes her sort of comedic presence more interesting because she is able to do this sort of bright persona that does have an edge. Whereas Tina Fey, not, I mean, I'm comparing them, but the interesting thing about Tina Fey is that she is sort of an essentially, she's like a good girl with a sardonic edge, you know? It's sort of a flipped script. Like, it seems like Tina Fey is like trying to play up the darkness in herself, and Amy Poehler is maybe a little bit seeking ways to tamp it down. And actually, sometimes I think she does it too much. One of the things Amy Poehler does that I like least, like, comedically, is this web series that she does, Smart Girls at the Party. It's meant to inspire young girls, I guess. I've only watched a couple episodes, so maybe it gets better. but I just find it so treacly and earnest. And, you know, her comedy is best when there's, like, a minor undercurrent of edge.
That is such a good point, the way that they're reversals of each other. I am now slightly rehabilitated. Like, I realize what's good in Yes, Please. But I will say, do not stay away from Bossy Pants while you're reading Yes, Please. Because if you don't want to do that, Bossy Pants is just, like, drop dead hilarious. Like, sentence after sentence after sentence is so funny. And one last thing I want to say in this cruel comparison is that people always say about comedians that they're deflecting. Like, they're, you know, she's not really talking about her divorce with Will Arnett. There's just this one throwaway sentence, which everybody keeps repeating, saying it was painful. I don't want to talk about it. Tina Fey does that in the beginning of her book with her scar, you know, but she does it so brilliantly. Like, she knows she's messing with you, basically. And she keeps telling you these fake stories to draw you in about her scar. And she never tells you where she got the scar from, but she tells you all the meaning around the scar. And I feel like it's just a brilliant meditation on the deflection skills of your average dark comedian.
Now, I just want to stick up for my girl, Amy. So when we were talking about Lena Dunham a few weeks ago in her new book, you gave her such credit for saying that she didn't want to talk about her relationship with Jack Antonoff. And to me, it's very similar to the way that Amy Poehler doesn't want to talk about her divorce from Will Arnett, which upset so many people because they were such a dream couple. Because it's so much easier. Yes, it's easier to write about the past than the present. What people want to read about is the present. But I prefer to have a bit of meditation and sort of space. There is no shortage of sort of, there's no shortage of attention on the internet to, you know, things that people are going through. And I don't know that I need that in this book. And obviously nobody would ever expect it in a book like this, I think.
I don't actually care what anyone says. It's how they say it. Like, I liked the way Lena Dunham wrote that paragraph about why she wasn't going to talk about him. It was convincing defense of her own decision, just as I think Tina Fey's scar thing was a convincing defense of how not to talk about something you don't want to talk about, whereas Amy Poehler just seemed a little banal, like, as a way of telling me why she wasn't going to talk about it. Like, I felt like she needed to work a little bit harder on it.
Well, one thing that I kept thinking about as I was reading these books, so someone once explained to me that 30 Rock was the most joke-driven show on the air, like, just, you know, jokes per minute. Mm-hmm. It was just incredibly intense, right? And Bossy Pants is full of sort of, like, sharp one-liners in a way that I didn't think this book was. And I think if you think about Parks and Recreation, Amy Poehler's show, it does feel more grounded in improv. I mean, obviously, there are a ton of jokes on it, but there are more bits than there mm-hmm. are. It's more sort of like atmospheric comedy, maybe. I'm sure I'm mangling all the technical terms, but it isn't sort of the sharp one-liner after one-liner rat-a-tat-tat of 30 Rock. And I feel like that sort of showed up in the book here. And then Lena Dunham's writing on Girls is more, certainly not as joke-driven in an obvious way. And so I feel like her book sort of reflected that.
Not to get too far off the topic, but I just have to say that after we read the Lena Dunham book, I had to watch a few old episodes of Girls, and it was really weird to come across, like, old episodes. You know, you remember that time where she goes to a reading at Michael Imperioli's thing, and the story that she reads, which she says she just, you know, wrote on the subway, is one of the stories that's in the book. And it that really kind of blew my mind. And, mm-hmm. and, you know, to talk about committing to a universe, or, you know, who knows where Lena Dunham ends and Hannah Horvath begins. But that kind of blew my mind. And I don't confuse Amy Poehler and Leslie Knope in the same way.
Why do we think that all of these women, these successful female comedians, are writing these advice books, essentially these advice / memoir books?
So I'm thinking, is this something that all famous people do? You know, here's how you can be like me, like a famous businessman would do that. You know, mm-hmm. is it any different than what Peter Thiel's book is? You know, a little bit about, you know, this is how I became the successful internet CEO, and here's how you can do it too. Or is this something that just is a woman-specific genre?
Well, it does kind of seem like there's elements of, is it Sophia Amorosa's book that we talked about? Girl Boss, is it? Mm-hmm. Because I have to give Amy Poehler credit again for, like, really emphasizing you got to work hard, you know, that there's talent and all of that, but you really also have to put in the hours. I think the answer to this may be, but I think, Hannah, that you're right about this is kind of an approach to writing about yourself that is slightly less egomaniacal than other ways. But Amanda Hess had a great line in her review of the Amy Poehler book and this sort of genre, which is that celebrity is an asset in selling a memoir and a liability in writing one. So I think, you know, it was kind of brilliant for whoever first came up with this advice approach, because it might be getting a little bit thin now, but it's kind of good.
Yeah, I mean, Tina Fey does say in Bossy Pants that, you know, people are always asking her what it's like to be the boss. And she understands that they would never ask Donald Trump what it's like to be the boss. And do you really like, you know, bossing around all those people and boss, 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 you know? So there's a little bit of Sheryl Sandberg in that note of resentment that she has. So maybe it is something that happens in the initial phase of successful women. And in the future, it'll just be straight memoir as opposed to memoir come advice book. Okay, let's move on to our last topic. But before I do that, I want to read a quick response from one of our listeners on our Gamergate topic, which I thought was very interesting. Nicholas Morey writes, "It should also be noted that the male characters are 7 feet tall, built like Hercules, often suave and invincible. Halo's Master Chief, for example. No male gamers I know bear any resemblance to the characters they emulate. So while it's, of course, troubling for women to be portrayed more or less as damsels in distress, it's also not great of the hypermachismo action hero is the only portrayal of men." Pretty good, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, let's move on to our last topic, which is Valerie Jarrett. This Obama advisor is the subject of a very long and interesting profile in the New Republic this week. You get a sense of the tremendous sway Valerie Jarrett has at the White House. Advisors come and go, but Valerie Jarrett always has the president's ear. This is the first time I can recall a woman in this position. What do we make of this? I thought the profile I suggest you read it, listeners. It was kind of a traditional profile of a consigliere. You know, it's a kind of profile that comes out in the last days or the last years of an administration, right? There's always somebody who everybody's looking to blame for the president's failure. And yet, Noam Schieber, who wrote the story, didn't make anything of the fact that she was a woman. It didn't come up. It didn't come up in any of the blind quotes. It didn't come up in his thinking about her. She was just kind of the person, the it blame you person, the way there always is. I thought that was really interesting, the kind of gender blindness of the story.
Well, do you think he should have made it gender blind? This is a genuine question. Like,
I would have, right? Yeah. Like, because I just find that interesting. I would find it an interesting reflection, first of all, on male-female friendships, you know? That is this an age of, you know, is this an age of marriage where it's okay for man and woman to have such a close collegial relationship? You know, nobody takes note of it. That's really interesting. There was one profile, I think the Vogue profile, which called Valerie Jarrett Barack's rock. And apparently, according to Noam Schieber, that's the one thing that, you know, rattled Michelle Obama a little bit. She's like, no, 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 that would be me. I am Barack's rock. But other than that, he didn't even like dig up any like catfighting between Michelle and Valerie. That just wasn't a part of the story. It was interesting.
I wanted to know more about how she became so close with Obama. Like, obviously, they've known each other forever in Chicago. But to me, and part of this is an access question. Noam's like, right, a terrific reporter, and he did a ton of digging on the story. But I just wanted to know a little bit more about what it was about Valerie Jarrett that Obama so values. She's clearly incredibly influential. And just none of these pieces have sort of given me that sense.
There was a piece that I think was in Politico by Carol Felsenthal, or maybe it was in a piece that Carol Felsenthal did for Chicago that pointed out, which was a complete write around. You know, she also certainly did not speak to Jarrett, but she pointed out that Jarrett had been the entree for both Obamas, or I think maybe they hadn't yet married, into that kind of golden circle in Chicago, the money and influence, and she was the person who brought him into that. You know, it's loyalty, and isn't that a good thing? Isn't longevity and loyalty, aren't they sort of values that we should cherish instead of sort of sniping about how long she's been there as if, you know, somebody else has got their eye on her seat? That seems a little strange to me, the general impulse. That wasn't in Noam's piece, but just as a general impulse, I kind of like it when people stick around.
Although he made a convincing case about why in this situation, sticking around was not necessarily the best thing for Obama. That in the early days, she provided the diverse opinions, mm-hmm, like you talked about, June, that it was just good to have her in the mix because you had Larry Summers and you had Rahm Emanuel and you had these kind of larger than life dude figures, mm-hmm, you know, all pushing Obama in the same direction. And then you had Valerie Jarrett kind of coming in as a breath of fresh air, providing a different view. But in these later years, when those guys are gone, then she has an undue influence. Like, a yes person is not what you want at this moment. You basically want a no person, you know. And again, no, you know, again, with the limited access any reporter can have, and I will say Valerie Jarrett is famously, you know, resistant, sends out memos saying no one can talk about her. I mean, she is, you know, reporters don't appreciate her either. So so it's going to be, you know, people will not have the truth about their relationship, and I think until many years after the White House.
Well, it's interesting, she in the first term was sort of the person from the outside who was, you know, basically in Clinton land, and she was the stalwart of Obama land. And now in the second term, she's like the old Washington hand who's like, right, maneuvering. It's funny how quickly things calcify in that town.
There are two things that I loved about the whole D.C. thing. The first is that Rahm Emanuel wanted to get rid of her by nominating her, or rather getting her nominated for Obama's Senate seat, which is like, so wait, the Senate is less important than... And then the other thing is that, like, in a way, she seems, as an outsider to Washington very much, she seems kind of familiar to me because I've seen her on The Good Wife. I've seen her on, like, that American Masters documentary about Billie Jean King. Like, she does do certain things that are very approachable, but she doesn't... You know, she doesn't actually talk to reporters. It's like that. It's a very modern sort of navigation of fame and access But it's, I'm sure, extremely frustrating when you're trying to write a profile.
Yes, she's fascinating to me. And she also, this is not really related to any of her work, but she also dates Ahmad Rashad, the like famous football player and, you know, like commentator, which I just find so interesting. Like she's, you know, she's navigating like a bunch of different worlds, Washington, Hollywood, like professional sports, the tech world. She goes to all kinds of, you know, the Chicago business world. I mean, that's what I mean about, I'm so curious about her. Like what, how is she able to be so chameleon-like and yet so in command of herself and the people around her? It's like truly impressive.
Yeah, and I loved your point, June, how quickly you can go from, you know, outsider to insider, how now no one was hinting, you know, she goes to fancy parties, she dates fancy people, you know, she likes to just be seen in the important places, and it just makes it, it gives an air of the whole administration as being kind of elitist and out of touch.
Which, I mean, that killed me though, because it's the, you know, he's the president. She's one of his top advisors. Like the idea that it's shocking that she should, you know, want to be at these events. Like if you're in the inner circle, that's kind of the nature of the inner circle. I mean, so when people were kind of sniping, you know, she gets to have one of the seats at bilateral talks. Well, yeah, she's really high up in the administration. I just didn't really quite understand why they felt that that was a reasonable sort of complaint. And, you know, to the extent that she is still providing that outsider input, even though she's now very much an insider, it's kind of seemed useful to me to have, you know, a non-expert, a generalist at, you know, at the table when there are only eight people around it. It doesn't seem so bad to me.
But if she's the only one he's listening to, that doesn't
Yeah, there's always this person.
That, though.
There's always this person when someone enters the decline moment. You know, Newt Gingrich had one. Bush had one. You know, this person who's like the last one left, you know, who has the president's ear, who's generally, you know, not their spouse. It could be an old friend from Arkansas or, you know, an old friend from Texas. But it's never a woman. I mean, that's what's interesting. It's never a woman. And so
And a black woman.
So that alone, and a black woman. I mean, it's so interesting once we actually learn, like you say, Noreen, what's the nature of relationship? What's her relationship with Michelle like, you know, what's her relationship with the press like? And then you get stories around this person. I mean, that story about the ambassador seat was a perfect story about the consigliere, because it's like, you know, they get to haughtily reserve this last seat, which they don't really deserve. You know, that's a perfect bit of gossip for that last person left standing.
Well, she's not just the consigliere. She's the office wife, which is a whole separate, sometimes fraught relationship. But that, you know, has there ever been a president with an office wife before?
Well, Bush and Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, that's true.
She was kind
that's
of his
true.
Office wife.
This is the new modernity. Office wives in the Oval Office.
Yeah, you're right. Okay, well, let's move on to our recommendations. June, what do you have for us today?
Well, I hope everybody's watching Jane the Virgin, but I'm sure they are, thanks to the Culture Gabfest segment on it a few weeks ago. So instead, I'm going to recommend a brilliant piece that was in Autostraddle, the lesbian culture website, yesterday. And it was a collection of one-star Yelp reviews of lesbian bars around the country. And it was the perfect encapsulation of the odiate ammo of relationship with lesbian bars, were like, God, they're kind of awful. At the same time, they're our awful. And it was just also a brilliant piece of web journalism. So highly recommend it.
So
what,
great.
What makes a lesbian bar particularly bad? Like, what is there any common theme?
God, the terrible service, the terrible music, the terrible patrons, the terrible everything.
So it's like any other terrible bar.
Exactly. But it's our terrible bar.
I am going to recommend comedian Megan Amram's Twitter feed. She is a protege of Amy Poehler. She's a writer on Parks and Rec. She's an up-and-coming comedian, and her Twitter feed is just super hilarious. She has a new book out called Science for Her, which we did not really discuss this week, but I can vouch for her Twitter feed, which is just fabulously funny and so distinctive. And she's such like a dark weirdo and also completely hilarious at the same time. I just love it. Noreen.
I am going to endorse an episode of a Slate podcast. I just listened the other day to an episode of Working by Hannah's husband, David Plotz. I guess this counts as log rolling. Anyway, He got a lot of attention for his Stephen Colbert interview, but what I loved was his interview with a perfumer. It's a woman who has like her own perfume line that she makes in Brooklyn, and it was so fascinating. I'm not particularly a perfume person. I don't wear it, but like there's a shop in my neighborhood that's like a very fancy perfume shop where they like will really sort of treat you incredibly well as a customer and like talk you through all the bouquets and blah, blah, blah. And David's interview with this woman like really helped you understand the like the creative process that goes into making scents, and it made me like wish I knew more about scents and paid more attention to them. So yeah, just download that if you are a perfume person or if you're not a perfume person.
So I will say, as David's wife, I got that woman sent me so many awesome free samples. She did. She sent me like doubles of her perfume. He actually called me from in that interview and asked me what perfume I wear. So I had to make something up that seemed very sophisticated. And then based on that, she then sent me some awesome samples.
So that's so
it
cool.
Was, you know, there's the log rolling for you. Okay. Well, we would like to thank our producer, Anne Hepperman, as always. Also the managing producer of Slate Podcasts, Joel Meyer, and also the executive producer, Andy Bowers. If you want more information about today's show, go to our show page, slate.com/XX. Also, check out our Facebook page, facebook.com/XXGabFest. You can tell me what you thought of the horrible things that I say to my children, my daughter particularly. Our email is XXGabFest@slate.com. Please subscribe to us on iTunes so we can spread the word about our podcast. And we will see you again in 2 weeks.
Well, I was dancing in the lesbian bar in the industrial zone. I was dancing with my friends and dancing alone. Well, the first bar, things were all right. But in this bar, things were Friday night. In the first bar, things were just all right. This bar, things were Friday night. And I was dancing in the lesbian bar. Oh, oh, I was dancing in the lesbian bar.